Hello, friends, and welcome to this edition of the Ames Tribune for Wednesday, July 29th. Your reader today is Dave Sauerman, and you are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. And here's our first story. COVID-19, 10 additional cases reported on Tuesday. This story written by Kylie Wellendorf. Story County's total number of positive COVID-19 tests rose by 10 as of 10 o'clock in the morning on Tuesday, according to state health officials. No additional deaths were reported in the county as of Tuesday morning. To date, a total of 11 county residents have died as the result of the virus, according to the state. At 10 o'clock in the morning on Tuesday, a total of 1,056 residents had tested positive for COVID-19, which is an increase of 10 cases over a 24-hour span. Of those who have tested positive in the county, 750 residents have recovered from the virus, according to data from Iowa's website. In Story County, state health officials reported that Acura Healthcare of Ames, which was identified by the state as having an outbreak in early July, has a total of 51 positive cases as of Tuesday, which is an increase of 2 cases since Monday. Of those who have tested positive from the virus, 17 have recovered, according to the website. As of Tuesday morning, a total of 11,581 Story County residents have been tested for the virus, according to state data. Across Iowa, 7 additional deaths were reported on Tuesday, bringing the state's total to 836. As of 10 a.m. Tuesday, an additional 253 confirmed cases have been reported by state officials, bringing the total of positive cases in Iowa to 42,738. Of those who have tested positive for the virus, a total of 30,508 Iowans have recovered from COVID-19. Our next story, Ames will pick a return to school plan on Monday. A vote on how the Ames School District will reopen in the fall will take place during Monday's virtual school board meeting, the district announced on Tuesday. Ames school board members vocalized concern during a 2-hour virtual work session Monday regarding what the beginning of the school year will look like for students after Governor Reynolds' new requirement that districts must provide at least 50% of instruction in person. Following a virtual meeting with Les White of Story County Public Health and officials from the Iowa Department of Education, Ames Superintendent Jenny Reisner said that her request for local control, which would allow the district to move to an online learning option without gaining approval from the state beforehand, was denied. "We went to explain our situation in Ames. We have college students returning. We were already on the uptick before that, and we wanted to have our options expanded," she said. "The answer was no, because they cannot approve any of those requests until the metrics come out and when we're closer to the beginning of school." Reisner said once the metrics come out, which the state has set for early August, the district, in consultation with the Department of Public Health, could make a request for online learning, which would then be decided by the Department of Education. If the district were to ignore the new guidelines and move forward with an online option, Reisner said there could be significant ramifications, such as the loss of funding or accreditation. "We have approval that if it snows an inch, we can be online. But if a bunch of kids show up with COVID in the school, we can't do anything about it," Board Vice President Alan Bierbaum said. At the start of the school year, districts can choose either a hybrid option or a full on-site return to class. Families can opt out of in-person schooling and move a student into required online learning. Those forms are available on the district website. As of Tuesday, around 500 families, or 10% of the district's students, have opted for online learning, according to district officials. "I'm really, really struggling with this vote," board member Gina Perez said on Monday. "I feel like having the online option taken away from us makes me feel like I have to compromise my own ethics. The safety of our students and the staff and the teachers in the district is all of our responsibility." Board member Sabrina Shields Cook echoed Perez's thoughts around the vote. "I just hope that the teachers and the families and the community understand that when we're voting, we may not be voting what our heart feels is the best thing, but we're voting for what is necessary to ensure that the district can continue moving forward," Shields Cook said. Bierbaum suggested a second symbolic vote on public record to show community members how the board would have wished the school year prior to the governor's July 17th guidance. Would have wished to start the school year, I should have said. "I appreciate that, but I feel like part of what I've been hearing is about all of the confusion going on in the district and how parents are already confused, and I don't want to add to the confusion so I can feel better," board member Monica Benekin said Monday. Reisner expressed confidence in mitigation steps at the elementary level, but had concerns about being able to keep staff members and older students safe. "I'm struggling with our secondary and middle school students. There's too many kids in the building. There's too many classroom switches. There's a lot of variables that we do not control. In an elementary setting, you control those variables because they're little and you very intentionally do not let them out of your sight. I am so sorry to the community and the board that we're in this situation as a state," Reisner said. "This is not what any of us wanted, and so I feel that we've been dealt a tough hand here in Iowa. We're doing the best that we can, but certainly putting families or people at risk is not what we wanted to do." Reynolds will hold a news conference at 11 o'clock in the morning, Thursday, about the return to school in Iowa. Schools across the state are having similar discussions. The Ankeny School Board late on Monday approved the district's recommended hybrid return to learn plan. The 4-3 vote came after more than 3 hours of public comments and debate. Our next story, a drive-through farmer's market starts on Friday. This story by Kylie Wellendorf. A weekly drive-through farmer's market kicks off on Friday night at the Central Iowa Expo site in Boone, and organizers are hoping it becomes the largest of its kind in Central Iowa. The site is normally home to the annual Farm Progress Show, which was set for September, but organizers canceled that in June due to COVID-19 concerns. "The idea came when we found out Farm Progress was going to have to cancel their show for the year," said Chris Blocker, Central Iowa Expo event manager. "We started thinking of the event, different ways, how we could utilize our space, and just took the concept of trying to help the farmers." The new venture for Central Iowa Expo invites attendees to check out locally sourced products from the comfort of their vehicle. It will run from 4 to 8 p.m. on Fridays until October 30th, located at 1827 217th Road in Boone. "Our anticipation is people can drive through, they can pull up and get what they want from the vendors, pay, and then drive all around," Blocker said. "Traffic will be kept on the streets. Vendors will have booths set up at the edge of the street so people can drive up or park within close proximity of the booths. The flow of traffic will go up and down the street easily so people can either stop in their cars and get out and order from their vehicles, or they can walk up to the booth if they feel comfortable doing that," Blocker said. The size of the property, which spans 106 acres, made the location ideal for spacing and the potential of inclement weather. "We have so many buildings, we're thinking that we will be able to move our vendors to an indoor facility, and we even have some that would continue to be drive-through," Blocker said. "Some of our buildings have a straight shot where they would have a continuous drive-through atmosphere to them. Even if we have bad weather, we anticipate that the farmers market can still go on." Though a Saturday date was initially planned for the market, Friday worked better for vendors who already had other sites booked for Saturdays, Blocker said. A handful of vendors will have booths at this Friday's market, including sellers of honey, jewelry, and food. Food trucks and music are also planned. We're excited that people will be able to stop, and also, if they don't want to buy stuff at the farmer's market, Blocker said, they can swing by and get a meal at a local food truck. We're excited about what's it going to look like. Picnic tables will be available for attendees to use. We're hoping by next month, we're going to be able to do live entertainment, Blocker said. We're going to start with just music and hopefully increase it to live entertainment. Those who plan to attend are asked to be considerate, Blocker said, and abide by social distancing and wearing a mask if they choose. We're excited, and I truly believe people are at a point where they are wanting to do things, Blocker said. What a great way to be able to get out and enjoy the elements. Our next story, supervisors vote to keep the county buildings closed through August. Following the month, Story County surpassed the 1,000 mark of COVID-19 cases. The county will see a roughly 33,000 person influx in August when Iowa State University students return to campus. Supervisor Loris Olson said during Tuesday's board meeting of supervisors, meaning that the reopening of the university and the schools in the county next month has an effect on the measured, data-driven approach that the board is relying on for a potential reopening of county buildings. The board unanimously voted to keep county buildings closed to the public during August and will accept in-person visits on an appointment-based system if the businesses cannot be fulfilled through alternative methods. Board Chairperson Linda Merkin told the Tribune that the board will continue to abide by its benchmarks for reopening, which include a 14-day downward trajectory in cases. We said, when evaluating a reopening strategy, one of the benchmarks we were looking at was a downward trend in cases, she said. The rise in cases slowed somewhat, but in June into July, we saw huge increases for Story County, with 1,056 positive COVID-19 cases as of 10 a.m. Tuesday. Story County has the 11th highest caseload in Iowa, according to the state's coronavirus website. The Story County Administration Building has been closed to the public since March 27, with exceptions granted to front lobby access for in-person voting in the June primaries. In the ensuing months, the county installed plexiglass shields for county employees and ensured social distancing methods in office spaces. The board also set occupancy limits for its public space, including an 11-person or less limit for the supervisor's second-floor meeting room and the assessor's room, and 17 people or less for the public meeting room. The supervisors, along with county staff, discussed the difficulties of reopening county buildings amid the high caseload and upcoming return of Iowa State University students. When it comes to the by-appointment process, Merkin said that if residents cannot conduct transactions or other business via email or over the phone, in-person accommodations will be a possibility. We know that there are certain points where doing business through email or over the phone does not work. So what we've been looking at is an appointment system, she said. I think our real concern was how many appointments can we book and still successfully manage social distancing. Continuing their cautious approach to any reopening, Merkin said, is the county's plan going forward. And the final story on the front page, supervisor denies request from Ames Mobile Park owner for financial assistance for demolition. This story written by Robbie Sequeira. The Story County Board of Supervisors on Tuesday rejected a request from Peter Gillen, owner of Hickory Grove Mobile Home Park in Ames, for financial assistance for the demolition of four mobile homes at the park. The Iowa District Court last July ordered Gillen to downsize the park from 38 to 34 homes by August after he was found in violation of the county's zoning ordinance or be found in contempt of court. Gillen said at the meeting that he has already demolished three trailers when they became vacant, and he has plans for demolition of the fourth trailer by next week. Citing heavy financial burden for the demolition, as a small business owner, Gillen identified $12,300 in expenses that he would like the county to assist with related to the demolition. On March 12, 2003, a letter to the code enforcement officer read that the park had been operating with 35 to 40 mobile homes over the years, and that while exceeding 40 lots would violate non-conforming use, the park could continue to operate with 35 to 40 lots if it was maintained properly. When Hickory Grove Mobile Home Park was developed in 1957, it started out with 34 homes on the property and added two additional homes when the county zoning ordinance went into effect in 1958. The county filed a complaint in 2018, and in March 2019, a decision ruled in favor of Gillen was reversed last July by District Court Judge James McGillen. McGillen, in his dissent, questioned whether the mobile home park's infrastructure could handle the increase in homes and residents, and whether the expansion was occurring in common areas previously used for the enjoyment of residents of the park. At Tuesday's meeting, Gillen admitted fault for violating the ordinance, but questioned the county's zoning ordinances and that the demolition of the trailers would impact residents seeking affordable housing. Turning inside the Tribune now, our next story. Barr condemns rioters in much-anticipated House testimony. This story comes to us from the Associated Press. Attorney General William Barr defended the aggressive federal law enforcement response to civil unrest in America, saying on Tuesday, violent rioters and anarchists have hijacked legitimate protests sparked by George Floyd's death at the hands of Minneapolis police. Barr told members of the House Judiciary Committee at a much-anticipated election year hearing, the violence taking place in Portland, Oregon, and other cities is disconnected from Floyd's killing, which he called a horrible event that prompted a necessary national reckoning on the relationship between the black community and law enforcement. Largely absent from these scenes of destruction are even superficial attempts by the rioters to connect their actions to George Floyd's death or any legitimate call for reform, Barr said of the Portland protests. The hearing marks Barr's first appearance before the House Judiciary Committee after 18 months in office, bringing him face-to-face with the panel that voted last year to hold him in contempt and is holding hearings on what Democrats say is politicization of the Justice Department under his watch. It comes during a tumultuous stretch in which Barr has taken actions cheered by President Donald Trump but condemned by Democrats and other critics. Among those actions is the Justice Department's decision to drop the prosecution of former Trump administration National Security Advisor Michael Flynn and Barr's urging for a more lenient sentence for Trump ally Roger Stone, a move that prompted the entire trial team's departure. Trump later commuted the sentence entirely. Opening the hearing committee, Chairman Jerry Nadler said the Trump administration had twisted the Department of Justice into a shadow of its former self, serving the powerful before average Americans. He said the committee has a responsibility to protect Americans from that kind of corruption. Nadler said Barr had aided and abetted Trump's worst impulses and excoriated him and the Justice Department for turning a blind eye to necessary reforms to police departments, for dismissing Black Lives Matter protests, and for flooding streets with federal agents to stop protesters. Republicans hit back hard in defense of Barr and Trump's administration. The top Republican on the panel, Ohio Representative Jim Jordan, used his opening statement to show an 8-minute video that spliced together images of violence by protesters around the country, showcasing law enforcement officers under attack in Chicago, Portland, and New York. The images were cut from hundreds of hours of racial injustice footage of largely peaceful protesters around the nation. Under combative questioning, Barr acerbically defended himself, but revealed little new information about his motivations or the Justice Department's recent actions on policing or otherwise. Fuming Democrats often use their 5 minutes to lay out their frustrations and cut him off as he attempted to answer questions. Many of the Democrats on this committee have attempted to discredit me by conjuring up a narrative that I am simply the president's facticum who disposes of criminal cases according to his instructions, Barr said in his opening statement. Judging from the letter inviting me to this hearing, that appears to be your agenda today. On policing, Barr's testimony underscores the Justice Department's ongoing effort to differentiate between increasing violence in some cities and Floyd's death, which has led to state charges against 4 officers and is under investigation by federal authorities. Massive but peaceful demonstrations followed Floyd's death in May. The Attorney General, speaking as Congress and the public pay respects in the Capitol to late civil rights icon Representative John Lewis, acknowledged to lawmakers Floyd's death struck a chord in the black community because it reinforced concerns black people are treated differently by police, but he condemned Americans who he says have responded inappropriately to Floyd's death through what he said was rioting and anarchy. As elected officials of the federal government, every member of this committee, regardless of your political views or your feelings about the Trump administration, should condemn violence against federal officers and destruction of federal property, Barr said. So should state and local leaders who have a responsibility to keep their communities safe. Civil unrest escalated in Portland after federal agents were accused of whisking people away in unmarked cars without probable cause. The people were detained and later released. And in Washington, D.C., peaceful protesters were violently cleared from the streets by federal officers using smoke bombs and pepper balls last month before a photo op by Trump in front of St. John's Church, where Barr had accompanied him. Barr defended the broad use of law enforcement power to deal with the situation, noting the protesters had earlier set fire to the church, and it was total consensus that you could not allow that to happen so close to the White House. The department's internal watchdog has opened investigations into the use of force and other tactics by agents in Washington and Portland. He also said the force was used because the protesters would not disperse from the area when law enforcement officials were trying to move back the security perimeter, a decision made the night before. When pressed on details, he pointed to the investigations. The use of pepper spray is warranted even if peaceful protesters are so harmed, he said. Beyond the federal response to the demonstrations, Barr was pressed in detail about his intervention in the Flynn and Stone cases, both of which arose from the special counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation. Democrats criticized him for partly taking into account Stone's health and age, which is 67, and said those standards haven't been used in other similar cases. When Stone's health was one of the factors considered by senior-level officials at the Justice Department, the point of the contention about the sentencing recommendation was over whether a specific sentencing enhancement over witness tampering would apply. Barr said that enhancement is traditionally applied to mafiosos, and he did not agree that it was warranted in Stone's case. Barr said he told the acting U.S. attorney that we are going to leave it up to the judge and that he ordered the revised recommendation to be filed. When the line prosecutor submitted an individual recommendation calling for a sentence of 7 to 9 years. And even though I knew I could get a lot of criticism for doing that, I think at the end of the day, my obligation is to be fair to the individual, Barr said. Republicans and Democrats also repeatedly revisited Mueller's probe, with Democrats arguing he downplayed the report to the public before it was released, and Republicans pressing him on the origins of the probe. The department is investigating the department's decisions as it started investigating Trump's ties to Russia during the Obama administration in 2016. In a prepared opening statement released by the department, Barr derisively referred to the bogus Russiagate scandal. Barr didn't read that part of his statement in the hearing room, but defended his actions as he questioned the probe. And another Associated Press story. The United States and Oregon are in talks about pulling agents in Portland. The Trump administration has started talks with the Oregon governor's office and indicated that it would begin to draw down the presence of federal agents sent to quell 2 months of chaotic protests in Portland if the state stepped up its own enforcement, a senior White House official said on Tuesday. The official stressed to the Associated Press that the talks with the office of Democratic Governor Kate Brown are in the early stages and there is no agreement. The official was not authorized to publicly discuss private conversations and spoke on the condition of anonymity. Brown did not immediately respond to a request for comment on Tuesday. Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler's office also did not immediately respond to an email. Just one day earlier, the U.S. Marshals Service and the Department of Homeland Security were weighing whether to send in any more agents. The marshals were taking steps to identify up to 100 additional personnel who could go in case they were needed to relieve or supplement the deputy marshals who work in Oregon, spokesperson Drew Wade said. Homeland Security was considering a similar measure with Customs and Border Protection agents, according to an administration official with direct knowledge of the plans, who was not authorized to speak publicly about the plans and spoke to the Associated Press on the condition of anonymity. President Trump did not let up on criticizing local authorities in their handling of the protests that began after George Floyd's death at the hands of Minneapolis police and have grown to include the presence of federal agents in Portland and other Democratic cities. Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkan said Tuesday that she had received confirmation that U.S. agents had left her city after being sent to Seattle last week to protect federal buildings amid lingering unrest. And here's an opinion piece written by Rob Tourneau. He writes for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and it's titled, "Can We Please Stop Spitting on Grocery Store Workers?" Just a few months ago, Americans Nightly lauded grocery store workers as heroes. Underpaid frontline workers who braved the ravages of coronavirus so households could put food on the table. These days, not so much. Being on the front line now means dealing with tired, impatient customers who don't want to follow the aisle's arrows and for some reason have a real problem wearing masks and following coronavirus restrictions. In Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, a Giant shopper spit on the face of an employee after being told to wait to enter the store because of capacity limits. In Lansing, Michigan, when a Kroger employee told a customer he needed to wear a mask, the shopper shot back, "I don't give a damn about your health." I wish these were isolated incidents. In Pittsburgh, an irate customer crouched under a plastic barrier and spit on an employee's face. In Mount Clemens, Michigan, a former mayoral candidate assaulted a grocery store worker and spit on police officers after being told to wear a mask. And on and on. Months ago, we asked these underpaid workers with little to no job security to risk their health so that we could stock our cabinets with Cheez-Its. In many cases, their own employers appeared to care more about profits than worker safety. Now, we're tasking grocery workers with managing the public health by instructing agitated shoppers to follow coronavirus mandates. It's not as if grocery store is a path for immunity to the pandemic. Last month, United Food and Commercial Workers International, which represents 1.3 million workers in the U.S., said at least 82 grocery store workers have died from COVID-19 and 11,500 have been infected. And most supermarket chains, such as Walmart, Trader Joe's, Whole Foods, Target, aren't even required to notify anyone if a worker dies or tests positive. People take drugstore and grocery store workers for granted. Wendell Young, president of Local 1776 Keystone State of the United Food and Commercial Workers, told the Inquirer back in March. Young was right then, and Young is right now. That opinion piece was written by Rob Tourneau, who writes for the Philadelphia Inquirer. You are listening to the Ames Tribune on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Your reader today is Dave Sauerman, and it is time for us to turn to the obituaries. Thomas Kevin Huseman, age 64 of Ames, passed away peacefully on Sunday, July 26, in his home, surrounded by family. Tom was diagnosed with esophageal cancer 1 month after he retired in August of 2017. His courage and determination to live during his three-year battle with cancer were an inspiration to everyone who knew him. A celebration of life and memorial service will be held on Saturday, August 1st, at First United Methodist Church in Ames at 11 o'clock in the morning. It will be a closed family service due to COVID limitations, but will be available to watch for all who are interested through a live stream at www.fumcames.org. Tom was the son of Charles and Joyce Huseman of Ames. He was born at Mary Greeley Medical Center October 26, 1955. He grew up in Ames and graduated from Ames High School in 1973. He started his college career at Iowa State, where he was a proud member of Phi Kappa Psi fraternity. He completed his Bachelor of Science degree in Computer Information Systems from West Texas State University and was named the Outstanding CIS Graduate Senior in 1984. He earned a Master's MBA in Finance from the University of Tulsa and was proud to complete the degree in 1 year with a 4.0 grade point average. Tom and Julie dated for 8 years and married in Ames at the United Church of Christ on April 3rd, 1982. Tom was known as the super smart computer guy in the family and worked in information technology throughout his career. He held numerous IT positions with Phillips Petroleum Company in Borger, Texas, Bartlesville, Oklahoma, Stavanger, Norway, Caracas, Venezuela, and Maracaibo, Venezuela. Tom and Julie retired from Phillips in 2000 and moved to Ames to be closer to extended family. After several months, Tom decided he was too young to retire and wanted to go back to work. He worked for Becker Underwood in their IT operations for several years. His next career move was to the state of Iowa, where he served as the Chief Information Officer for the Department of Human Services. His final employer was Wells Fargo in West Des Moines, where he served as Vice President in the Mortgage Division. Tom successfully completed his career and retired from Wells Fargo in the fall of 2017. Left to cherish his memory is his beloved wife, Julie, and their three children, Kevin Huseman of Ames, Melissa Huseman of Austin, Texas, and Karina Huseman, Kendall of Manning, Iowa. He had one grandchild, Bianca Ann McConkie of Ogden, Iowa. Karina married Mark Kendall on July 25th, 2020, 1 day before his passing away. The couple is expecting their first child, Ellen Kathy Marie Kendall, due on December 8th. And Tom was thrilled to meet his second granddaughter. Tom also leaves behind many members of his loving family, his mother, Joyce Huseman of Ames, his sister and brother-in-law, Linda and Tom Thomas of Ames, his brother and nephew, Ted and Nick Huseman of State Center, and his sister and nephew, Laura and Grant Beckett of Everett, Washington. His children were his pride and joy, and he spent his life making sure they were taken care of in every way. Tom was so proud of the ways his children grew into exceptional adults, each with their own unique successes. In his son, Kevin, he saw a remarkable and resilient father, and a man who turned his culinary passion into a thriving career as a chef at Greek House Chefs. In his daughter, Melissa, he saw a driven woman who started and successfully ran her own creative consulting business while pursuing music on the side, a passion they shared. In his daughter, Karina, he saw a young woman who overcame many obstacles to create a beautiful life and pure family with the man of her dreams. He was thrilled at the milestones they each achieved in his lifetime and had high hopes for their futures and all they will create as a continuation of his legacy. Beyond his passion for his family, Tom had many hobbies and interests that fulfilled and enriched his life. His lifelong love was running, and he completed 12 marathons in cities across the world. Notable locations included Copenhagen, Denmark, Frankfurt, Germany, Stavanger, Norway, and London, England. Tom was most proud of achieving his running career goal of qualifying for and running the elite Boston Marathon, successfully doing so two times, in 2004 and 2005, by the age of 50. Tom was at his best when entertaining family and friends, and especially loved doing so at his happy place, on the lake. In his youth, he was a talented water skier and loved being out on the boat throughout his entire life. He enjoyed many lake weekends at Grand Lake in Oklahoma and Clear Lake, Iowa. He was a magnificent cook and in recent years took up a love for gardening. Tom's love for music was unmatched and he had classic rock playing in the background all the time. He was a talented trumpet player, even having marched in the Iowa State Marching Band for a time. Tom was a passionate investor and loved working the stock market at 4 o'clock every morning. Tom and Julie had an exceptional network of cherished friends from all over the world. Fun, travel, and adventure were always a big part of their lives, and he was cracking jokes with his friends even into his final days. His people were his everything, and he had a huge heart and a brilliant mind. Tom was predeceased by his father, Charles Huseman, his mother and father-in-law, Keith and Ellen Landon, his brothers-in-law, Monty Hemphill and Larry Beckett. We are sure he is thrilled to be reunited with them all. Arrangements are under the care of Adams Funeral Home of Ames. Online condolences may be left for the family at adamssoderstrom.com. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to the First United Methodist Church or Youth and Shelter Services. The family would like to thank all who knew and loved Tom and the Husemans for their unending support and love through the past few years. He finished his race well, and we are so proud of him. Our next obituary, Marvin Lewis, age 61, passed away peacefully and happily at his home on July 17, with his church family caring for him. After years of his body just giving out from heart and renal failure, Marvin was born February 23, 1959, to Betty Phipps and Robert Lewis. He was raised in Chicago, Illinois, and was baptized as a Catholic, attending St. Joseph's Church and Grammar School and Waller High School. He moved to Iowa around 2004. He had relationships with many around town, from city leaders to the homeless. He had a heart to help young men become young men of integrity. He often took up the cause of the homeless and those finding themselves in tough situations. He loved making music with many musicians around town, writing songs, telling stories, designing clothing, restoring bikes, giving away bikes, and collecting all things that might be useful. Marvin was sort of a modern-day Robin Hood who used whatever means he could to help others. He believed God pointed him to Oakwood Road Church, now City Church of Ames and Des Moines, around 2006. He loved this church and would often invite someone he just met to visit the church and see why he loved it. He loved the big vision of the church to strengthen church leaders on every continent and to seek the welfare of the city here in Ames, especially reaching out to people who needed to rebuild their lives. In his church family, he always looked out for the elderly and his little buddies, the children, and he sought out leaders. He got excited about the sound teaching room, got excited about the sound teaching from God's Word that he could share with others. He found a family to belong to and a vision he could become a part of here in Ames. Marvin was confident in his relationship with God. He was confident that his sins were forgiven because of God's grace to him, not based on things he had done, but based on trusting that Jesus' death on the cross paid for his sins. Marvin had two final requests. He asked us to record a song that he still had within him, and two, he wanted his family and friends to trust in Jesus' payment as he had trusted in it. He wanted them to live life with joy and purpose. Marvin dreamed of having a big megaphone, using his gigantic speakers to share his music and message to everyone who would listen. He was very encouraged that some of his family members from Chicago were able to visit him before his death. His six siblings are Carolyn Phipps, Elaine Phipps, Rochelle Brown and her husband Wendell, Demetria Harris and her husband Ramon, Danny Phipps, and Milo Phipps. Marvin is preceded in death by his parents and two brothers, Robert and Michael. Join us Saturday, August 1st at 10 o'clock in the morning, Central Time, for a celebration memorial via Zoom to remember Marvin's story and celebrate his life. The Zoom memorial link is https://us02web.zoom. Zoom ID 85395424249. Marvin was one of a kind and will be greatly missed. And our next obituary, Vance Clark Weltha, a loving husband, father, and community servant, served his last call on Saturday, July 25th, at the age of 55. A visitation will be held Thursday, July 30th, from 4 until 7 p.m. at the Baxter Community Center in Baxter, Iowa. Funeral services will be held on Friday, July 31st at 10 o'clock in the morning at the Neil Salas Sports Complex, 309 West Station Street in Baxter. Burial will follow at Restland Cemetery in Baxter. Fredgill Funeral and Cremation Service has been entrusted with the care of Vance and his family. And here's Dennis the Menace, the comic for today. Dennis and his friend Tommy are at the, in a backyard swimming pool. Dennis is at the top of a slide getting ready to go into this tube-type swimming pool. And he says to his friends, "I know how to have fun, but my mom says I don't know when to quit." And here's the real-life comic for today. Husband and wife, man and significant other, woman, are sitting in the car together, driving on their way home or away from a event of some kind. And the wife says, "That was so embarrassing." And the man says, "Why?" And she says, "You didn't see? Janet and I were wearing the same cute flowered COVID masks. I was mortified." And here's today's coronavirus news briefing. The United States death toll from COVID-19 is nearing 150,000 on Tuesday, as several states set weekly fatality records, and Florida reported a one-day record for deaths. Florida's 186 deaths raised the total there to more than 6,000, Governor Ron DeSantis, who 3 weeks ago ordered in-classroom learning when schools reopen next month. He's eased his rhetoric in recent days. He now wants schools to ensure parents have the choice between in-person and distance learning for their kids. In Tennessee, Dr. Deborah Brix, the White House's coronavirus response coordinator, urged Governor Bill Lee to shut down bars and limit indoor restaurant dining to help curb an explosion of infections among young people. Lee said no. Several states on Monday set 7-day records for virus deaths. Others set records for new cases. Tennessee set records for both. Hiding from COVID-19, doctor warns people not to miss their cancer screenings. More than a third of Americans have missed cancer screenings because of COVID-19, concerned health experts who warn this could be another fatal consequence of the coronavirus pandemic. Prevent Cancer Foundation. The results of more than 1,000 respondents in their survey found that about 35% of Americans have missed routine cancer screenings because of COVID-19 fears. About 43% have missed medical appointments. People should understand that they are most likely to die from cancer that has progressed as they sit at home to prevent COVID-19 than they are to die from COVID-19, said Dr. Therese Beavers, medical director of the University of Texas at Anderson Cancer Center. Twitter removes cure tweets from Trump and Trump Jr., blocking the latter for 12 hours. Twitter has removed a post that President Donald Trump had retweeted in which a doctor proclaims, without evidence, that there is a cure for the coronavirus. The president's retweet was in violation of our COVID-19 misinformation policy, Twitter said in the statement. The social media giant also restricted the account of Donald Trump Jr. after removing a post in which doctors touted the alleged benefits of hydroxychloroquine in fighting the coronavirus. The president's son was blocked from retweeting for 12 hours. Big tech is intent on killing free expression online and is another instance of them committing election interference to stifle Republican voices, Trump Jr. spokesman Andrew Serbain said on Tuesday. Head of China CDC gets injected with experimental coronavirus vaccine. The head of the Chinese Center for Disease Control and Prevention says he has been injected with an experimental coronavirus vaccine in an attempt to persuade the public to follow suit when one is approved. I'm going to reveal something undercover. I am injected with one of the vaccines, Gao Fu said in a webinar on Sunday hosted by Alibaba Health, an arm of the Chinese e-commerce giant and Cell Press, an American publisher of scientific journals. I hope it will work, he said. The Associated Press reported this month that a state-owned Chinese company injected employees with experimental shots in March, even before the government approved testing in people, a move that raised ethical concerns among some experts. Gao did not say when or how he took the vaccine candidate, leaving it unclear whether he was injected as part of a government-approved human trial. He did not respond to requests for comment. Our next story, Maduro's hold on Venezuela tightens as coronavirus surges. This story comes to us from the Associated Press. More than a year after a young U.S.-backed politician rose up to oust Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, the socialist leader holds up yet a strong grip on power with a boost from the novel coronavirus. Venezuelan opposition hoped that 2020 would bring new momentum after several failed pushes to overthrow Maduro. Then came the coronavirus. Analysts say the pandemic has helped suck away the opposition's already flagging support. Fear of contagion has helped keep protesters off of the streets, and the virus-driven end of a slight economic upturn has kept Venezuelans focused on daily survival and not politics. Against that backdrop, Maduro has instituted sweeping measures ensuring Venezuela's electoral system is bent in his favor. Meanwhile, opposition leader Juan Guaido's popularity has continued to plummet. In many ways, the pandemic has been more of a blessing to Maduro than a curse, said George Ramsey, a Venezuelan expert at the Washington office on Latin American think tank. Maduro is stronger now than at any point in the past 18 months. Venezuelan officials announced the first COVID-19 cases in mid-March, prompting Maduro to enact a nationwide lockdown that remains in effect. At least 146 have died, and roughly 16,000 have fallen sick, according to the government's count, likely a vast underestimate because of limited testing. On nightly broadcasts, Maduro and his lieutenants update citizens on the numbers. They share information on shipments of humanitarian aid from allies like Russia and China, and they decree new measures to halt the virus. Maduro has had an opportunity to show his territorial control, said Luis Vicente Leon, a Venezuelan political analyst. Engineer Francisco Mato, once among thousands cheering Guaido, said today his hopes of a political change have taken a back seat. You have to fight for your family, for food, and make sure we don't get sick, said Matos, who is 42 and wears a face mask while shopping for groceries. Politics seemed like a distant option. Guaido, then a relatively secondary figure in the opposition, announced plans to oust Maduro in early 2019 and quickly gained support from more than 50 nations, led by the United States. But his call for military uprising that April failed, and by the end of the year, street demonstrations had noticeably shrunk in size. Guaido's only local outlet now is social media, which many Venezuelans struggle to access because of frequent power outages. As head of the National Assembly, he leads weekly legislative sessions through online conference calls, which are not widely accessible to the public. While the dictatorship is every day more isolated, we hold up the banner of unity, he wrote in a recent Twitter post with a mere 514 shares. For many Venezuelans, the pandemic has heightened an already intense sense of isolation. International flights that had become increasingly sparse are now entirely cut off. Gas shortages and the lockdown make travel within Venezuela almost impossible. Human rights advocates say the Maduro government is using the quarantine to further erode civil liberties. The Caracas-based prisoner rights group, Foro Penal, said Maduro's government this year has arrested 281 people the group considers political prisoners, most of them during the quarantine. They include journalists and doctors who have spoken out against the government's handling of the coronavirus. McMuir Evans, who runs news website Punto de Corte, was arrested this month, a day after tweeting comments expressing hope that a high-profile Maduro supporter diagnosed with COVID-19 survives the illness so that he can be judged on earth rather than get divine justice. Evans, a leftist who supported the late Hugo Chavez, but whose publication often criticizes Maduro's government, recorded his arrest, showing police outside his door while making a claim, statement. Our sacred right to freedom of expression, criticism, political action, defense, and resistance against tyranny should never be considered an act of hatred, he said, before being taken away on charges of violating an anti-hate law. Authorities haven't said what triggered the charge. Foro Penal's executive director, Alfredo Romero, said the prisoners often are not allowed courtroom hearings or visits with attorneys and relatives. The pandemic is being used to further deprive them of the right to a defense and due process, he said. The Supreme Court, loyal to Maduro, recently appointed a new elections commission, including three members who have been sanctioned by the United States and Canada without participation of the opposition-led Congress, as the law requires. The court also took over three leading opposition parties, appointed new leaders the opposition accuses of conspiring to support Maduro. The legislative election is scheduled for December 8th, and thus far the opposition has indicated it will not participate. Michael Penfold, a Caracas-based fellow at the Wilson Center in Washington, said Maduro's goal is to behead the leadership of the Democratic opposition by electing this new National Assembly. Maduro also seeks a loyal opposition. hoping to continue to gain time until the international community loses any hope of change in the country, Penafold said. Recent polling by the independent firm Datanalius shows Maduro's approval rating at a dismal 13%. Guaido's is twice as high, but has tumbled from 60% in February 2019, shortly after he declared himself Venezuela's rightful president before adoring crowds. President Donald Trump recently expressed doubt that Guaido is capable of removing Maduro, saying he seems to be losing power. "We want somebody that has the support of the people," Trump told Telemundo. "I support the person that has the support of the people." The developments come and fresh indicators that Venezuelans are increasingly hungry. Venezuela is now the poorest country in the Americas, according to study by researchers at three Venezuelan universities. Shortly before the pandemic, the United Nations World Food Program released a study finding that one in three people there are going hungry. A dance instructor, Belinda Venezuela, who is 60, said her support for Guaido is unwavering. But these days she is preoccupied with making sure she doesn't get sick whenever she goes out to shop for food. Maduro has opposition supporters where he wants them, unable to take to the streets, she said. And that brings us to the end of reading the Ames Tribune for this Wednesday, July 29th. Your reader today has been Dave Sauerman. We want to thank you for listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped.